Hi, and welcome to Watch Next, the podcast where we recommend what you should watch next. I'm Dr. Ruby Sanchez Lozoya. Each episode, join me in a conversation with fascinating scholars and thinkers to explore world cinema in a way that feels warm, inviting, and completely jargon-free. In today's episode, we talk with Professor of Music Jacqueline Avila about The Handmaiden. Jacqueline Avila is an Associate Professor of Musicology and Ethnomusicology at the University of Texas at Austin. Her research examines film music and the intersections of identity, tradition, and modernity in the Hollywood and the Mexican film industries. Her book, Cines Sonidos, Film Music and National Identity During Mexico's Época de Oro, is published with Oxford University Press. Since we will be discussing the film in detail throughout the episode, consider this your spoiler reminder. And with that, let's begin.
Hello, Austin. I'm listening.
Welcome, Jackie, to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So, for the listeners, this is a rare treat that we actually were able to, Jackie and I, see the film together last night. We had bulgogi. I made bulgogi for Jackie. And
it was
delicious. Yes, I'm glad to hear that. And then we watched the film together. Now that you have had some time to like percolate or think about the film or have some distance with the film, do you have any different thoughts or reactions to the film? What were you thinking? And now, what do you think of the film?
I enjoyed the film. When I was watching it, I felt horribly uncomfortable.
Yeah, okay. That was my question. I'm like, how would it have been if you had watched it by yourself compared to watching it with me?
Well,
was that part of the comfort?
Yeah, I think that was a different level. I mean, we've been friends for a while, but for me, when it comes to like any erotic thrillers or anything with erotica in it, I always have to make sure I'm like with a safe person. And I do definitely feel safe with you. But it wasn't that. It was those scenes were fine. It was the torture scenes.
Yeah. I noticed that.
The torture scenes. Even by myself, I think it was just a very uncomfortable moment. And I went into this movie not knowing anything. And that's usually when that happens, I have a greater reaction to it. So there's been a few Mexican films where I just went to the theater and I had absolutely no idea what I was going to sit and watch. And then those are the ones that had the lasting impression because I didn't already make up my mind or make up parts of the story up in my mind beforehand. But this one took some, I like to call them sharp turns.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear that a film that is very visually striking. Was there something about the music that caught your attention? What is one of the things that you listen to as a music professor when you're watching a film or a series? But you also teach a class on the music, sound, and the moving image.
Yes.
Which is basically about global cinema and its soundscapes. Mm-hmm. What is something that you hope that your students get out of those classes? And can you tell us a little bit more about that class?
Yeah, that was a class that I put together like a few, many years ago when I was working in Tennessee. And it was something that actually incorporated the research that I do on Mexican film. And from my own experience, when I was an undergrad and grad student taking any film classes or any film music classes, the focus was pretty much on Hollywood cinema. Mm. And when I started doing my research on Mexican film and Mexican film music, I wanted some way to incorporate that. But you can't just have one class. I didn't want to have one class on just like Mexican film music. Not like that. I wanted to engage with other industries on a broader level. But and it also it's not organized by country. Some weeks I focus on a director like Pedro Almodovar and the composers that he features. Since I was in Texas, Wes Anderson is another one. Let me think. Mira Nair as well. But then there's also like themes that come up. So one of the themes I work on is on the prostitute melodrama in Mexican film. And any focus on sex and sex workers is a pretty popular theme and genre in other industries as well. So how does each industry kind of handle that? What type of music is being utilized for those particular films? And I also have a film on the spaghetti western and the charro films from Mexico. So two iterations of cowboys on two different continents. And one is supposed to be representative of the U.S., but through the lens of Italy and using a lot of music by Ennio Morricone. And then in Mexico, the Comedia Ranchera, where you have a singing cowboy singing rancheras and other types of music. Yeah, it's supposed to, I don't know how to describe this. It's supposed to show how demonstrate to students how complicated the system is, and also what you're missing when you just say, "I'm watching a movie."
And that's great.
Now I'm watching and listening to a movie, because the senses are very much alive. And I think it was the sound theorist Michel Chion who said, you enter into that audio video visual contract when you go into a movie theater, or when you're going into any type of screening space, that whatever you see and hear is going to be a type of reality. So I know for a lot of people, I'm watching a movie, but I generally say I'm watching and listening to a movie or to a series, because I think taking both senses together is really important in order to get that whole message. But it takes a lot of training, because there are some times where I don't get all of it the first time. Mm-hmm. But you can say that too when you're just focused on the visual aspect. You have to watch and listen to movies like repeatedly in order to get the whole thing. So I don't know how many times I've seen Víctimas del Pecado when I was writing my book. I think I have the whole thing memorized.
And this is the one that you have the Criterion blurb, right?
Yeah.
This is like very impressive to have Jackie on the studio, which is featuring the Criterion booklet for Víctimas del Pecado.
Víctimas del Pecado, Victims of Sin from 1950.
Actually, I think it's a great segue of why I want to talk to you about this film, or how we ended up with this film. So to remind our listeners, The Handmaiden is a 2016 South Korean erotic psychological thriller directed by Park Chan-wook and set in the 1930s Japanese occupied Korea. And Park Chan-wook is perhaps best known for his film Old Boy. The score is done by Cho Jong-wook, who also did the scoring for Old Boy. So he has worked with this composer and music director in multiple films. In The Handmaiden, a pickpocket named Suki is hired by a conman to become the handmaiden of a wealthy Japanese woman, Lady Hideko, in a plan to seduce her and steal her fortune. So imagine me right now talking like Stefan from SNL, because this film has everything, you know? And some of these things are things that you were looking for or wanted to see in the film that we suggested for the podcast. The historical film, checked. Mm-hmm. The film adaptation, checked. It's a film adaptation from a 2002 Victoria-era historical crime novel called The Fingersmith by Sarah Water. But also, this film has beautiful costuming, gorgeous locations, amazing camera work, but also very explicit sex scenes, very explicit torture scenes, and a live octopus. So it's a lot.
It has a lot of fingers and pies, yeah.
Yeah, and like in terms of layering, I think the movie is very, very visually striking. Mm-hmm. When I think about it, I think of those, not only the scenes, but also the costuming, the setting, the cinematography. So for me, it was much more difficult to pay attention to the music. Mm-hmm. And I'm already a person who's not very attuned to listening to music in general. So I was very curious to hear what you actually listened to when you were watching this film together, when you were watching and listening to this film together. We came to this because, as I mentioned, you wanted an adaptation from a literary piece. And because you work in Mexican cinema, I was thinking immediately, oh, like Water for Chocolate and Pedro Páramo. But I think I'd much rather be hit by a train than talk about Pedro Páramo. This is going to be out.
You're going to cut that out.
100% that's out. But you've seen like Water for Chocolate, mm-hmm. and you've seen Pedro Páramo. So part of the thing, it was like find something that was new to you.
Yeah.
We also talked about the adaptation of Devdas, the 1917 Bengali novel of the same name.
Right.
That has multiple Bollywood adaptations, and you have taught a class in it before.
Yeah, that's in my music, sound, and movie and image class.
I was very excited to talk about that. But again, you've seen it, this is not new to you. And we also consider Heather, which is a 2014 adaptation. It's a 2014 adaptation of Shakespeare's Hamlet. Mm-hmm. And it's something I have taught in my class before. So after some back and forth, we ended up in this film, The Handmaiden. And one thing I want to ask you is that in addition to music, there's also this interest in the soundscape of the film. Mm-hmm. What do you think in general about the music of the film and the soundscape of the film? Does it contrast to the visually striking images? Because to me, it sounds like much softer than the shocking images in the film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. I would call it more meditative.
Mm.
I found it, it didn't push its way into the forefront. I think it created a nice balance between the visuals. And it definitely, I felt that the underscoring definitely heightened some moments of the film, especially like the sequence of the wedding when they're running through the fields. Like there's a really quite beautiful cue at that point that just features strings. The sound design I thought was freaking brilliant.
Mm.
Was just brilliant, and it just had to do with those bells.
Uh huh.
That was the most striking thing of the whole movie, I think, sonically, was the bells. And if you listen to the whole soundtrack, they have the scene where Hideko and Suki are using the bells at the end. Mm-hmm. They actually incorporated it into the musical soundtrack, or the musical track, depending on how you want to look at it.
What is the difference?
Well, so there's the dialogue track, there's the music track, and then there's special effects track. But when you buy the music, it's called the soundtrack.
Uh-huh.
But all three of those are the soundtrack.
Right.
They make up the soundtrack.
I see.
So the soundtrack that you can listen to on Spotify or
Got
on
it.
Apple Music has, I think, three dialogue tracks from the film.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was a very, very interesting choice.
In terms of style, visual style, both this and Old Boy and other Park Chan-wook's films, it feels very similar.
Mm-hmm.
It's very like going for not just shock value, but it's very interested in shock value. It leans into the mm-hmm. shock of things, has very like whooping cameras. It's very mm-hmm. interesting choices of where he puts the camera. What oh. images he...
Yes. That's
we were thinking
sure.
of the same thing.
Yes.
where he puts the camera, like as a visually striking filmmaker, I see. In terms of the sound, this feels very different, especially to Old Boy. Mm-hmm. In both films, there is an interest in classical music.
Mm-hmm.
There's a brilliant scene that I discuss with my students, which is a torture scene in Old Boy. Mm-hmm. And they're using Vivaldi's Winter.
Mm.
At that moment. Ooh. But here it feels much softer. Can you tell us a little bit more about how would you describe the music in the film?
I can't speak specifically to the torture scene because honestly, I was just like, I can't look at this. And sometimes I cover my ears when that happens. The composer uses a lot of extended techniques for the instruments. So there are those meditative moments and I think you would call it more atmospheric, like it was done in order to really create the space, the environment in which this house is located, and also how they're moving, the characters are moving from different spaces, like inside the house versus outside by that cherry tree, mm-hmm. the cherry blossom tree. And when the two female characters are running away across the field, there's the music itself is kind of speeding that time up.
Mm-hmm.
I like those particular moments because either the music can be very slow towards the image, like moving in counterpoint, or it could be fast, kind of in parallel, depending. That's when I think a lot of the music is very much foregrounded. The other element, and I was just saying about these extended techniques, is during these scenes where you're starting to question the psychological state of mind of Hideko.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The composer uses a lot of glissandi for the violin. So it's kind of like if you're this moving up and down the strings.
Uh-huh.
And it just creates this very uncomfortable sensation.
Ah.
So we as in our human ears, who are especially our westernized ears, dissonance is very uncomfortable.
Huh.
So often a lot of the cues that I listen to on the actual soundtrack, they don't resolve. They don't give you that sense of resolution.
What does that mean?
You don't feel a sense of completion.
And how would you feel a sense of completion?
That the song has ended.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. I see. No,
you arrive to a cadence and then it ends and then you can move on to the next one. But a lot of times it just kind of leaves it almost like a question mark.
It feels like it's left hanging.
Yeah, it's left hanging. And so especially for scenes that were featuring Hideko where in Act One, where Suki's telling the counts that she's starting to go a little crazy. He uses a lot of those strings, and a lot of the bending of pitches, a lot of flutter tongue in the flute, like. So those types of techniques, especially sonically speaking, they could really heighten that sense of discomfort for an audience member.
That's very interesting. I would have never noticed that.
Yeah, horror films are very good with those particular techniques, and especially like the jump scare ones.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, if I go see, I mean, horror is not my favorite genre, but it's my husband's favorite genre, so I will watch, and I will not listen. Mm-hmm. I will cover my ears, but I will watch these movies with him. But it's just the total discomfort of dissonance, especially in the upper strings and a lot of other extended techniques, maybe like in upper woodwinds, these types of sounds, that high piccolo sound, these really high pitches. Yeah, I can't. It's hard for me.
It's interesting that you're comparing these techniques to horror, because I think Oldboy 2 and like a lot of the filmography of Park Chan-wook is interested in this kind of horror, either body horror, psychological horror, in what you see, mm-hmm. and what the plot is about. And I think The Handmaiden has some of it as well, even mm-hmm. though this is not the horror of like ghosts and apparitions, but it is a psychological thriller.
Mm-hmm.
There is something very disturbing that actually happens in the film. And you also even see it in the poster. Like, I remember when we were talking about the beginning, before watching it, like, oh, I thought it was a horror movie, because it does have this kind of nod to the genre. I think it's a brilliant poster. There's like hands everywhere. There's this the whites of the dresses that she's wearing compared to like the very black, dark background, and almost disembodied hands of, you don't know who they belong to.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of hints to the intricacy of the plot, and also the double bluffs and the lies and the deceits that are like who's lying to whom. And you don't know this until the film progresses and you realize that who you thought was the villain was actually not the villain, who you thought was the victim was not actually the victim. And it's just a lot of intrigue in the film.
Yeah, it's definitely those layers. When I saw the poster, I thought it was a horror film, which prevented me from actually seeking it out.
Wait, and it's funny because now I'm thinking about it. Is it a horror movie? And what do we gain by thinking of it as a horror movie? Because it does have these haunting, ghostly features like the ant, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, part of that house reminded me a little bit of The Turn of the Screw. And it was Benjamin Britten, The Turn mm-hmm. of the Screw. So it's this house in the countryside, and it's being haunted by a butler, but the butler is haunting a little boy. And in the opera, the butler sings a lot of these octatonic scales. It's like this element of exoticism is supposed to be this reference to the supernatural. And the house, just visually speaking, like the house itself just reminded me of that isolated country
right.
house from these British novels,
right.
British horror novels. Now, The Turn of Screw, I believe, is a Henry James novel, if I remember correctly. This is another book I haven't read, but I have seen the opera. And the isolation of the characters, in particular, in this house, like it's just maybe one or two people who own the house, but they're surrounded by all of these servants, and that isolation of what you can do. I mean, think back into COVID and any time that we're stuck indoors all the time, we tend to spiral.
Mm-hmm.
So in a huge space like that, you would think you would have a lot to do. But if you're just, you know, sequestered to particular rooms, so as Heideko was just like in one particular space when she wasn't in that creepy ass library,
mm-hmm.
You know, she had to hold her shit together, and she did it in a very convincing way.
And I think as you were talking, it made me think of what they do with the production design of the house.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very gothic mm-hmm. influence house that reminds you of like the British gothic novels, right? It's the house that is by itself in the countryside, check. It's big and menacing, check. And it has all these levels to it, check. The servants are very important to the plot, check. So for me, it's one of why the film to me is very interesting in terms of adaptation. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I like about adaptation is this ability for them to go beyond the source material and start rethinking about it, mm-hmm. or start thinking about it in a different light. And not only do we see this by moving or transporting this story from England to Japanese occupied Korea, but also make interesting connections of what we see and what we hear. And I think sonically, what you were talking about, these elements of when Lady Hideko is shown, kind of is hinting to those gothic elements of the novel, mm-hmm. or that the gothic novels that we can think of. I think that's very interesting. You mentioned the library. Mm-hmm. And that's one scene that you said you were very intrigued by. This moment is towards the end of the film. It's a minute and 50 in the film. It's towards the end of the second part. So it has been revealed. A lot of things have been revealed. We know now that Lady Hideko is in cahoots with the conman, which is Kan Fujiwara. And they are in cahoots to deceive Suki. We also know that Lady Hideko and Suki have decided also to run away together, to betray Kan Fujiwara and run away with all the money. Just before they're about to meet him and they're about to escape the house, Lady Hideko shows Suki the library that has been mentioned before, but Suki has not seen it. And she also knows, Suki knows, that Lady Hideko has been reading something in Japanese, but she didn't know what she was reading. So they go to the library just before they leave, and Lady Hideko shows her a book that Suki cannot read. But as she's flipping the pages, she sees a drawing of a woman with two octopus, which is a nod to an actual Japanese woodblock print. It's an actual woodblock print from the Edo period. But it has been changed to show Lady Hideko, and we know it's her because she's wearing the earrings that had been very important in the film before. And at that moment, then Suki finds out what Lady Hideko has been reading, which is all this erotica that she's been forced to read since she was very, very young. So in this moment, when Suki finds out what Lady Hideko has been reading to the gentleman that come to the library, she loses it, mm-hmm. right? She tears apart the book that had the drawing on it. Then she starts tearing everything apart, all the books in the library, the scrolls. She tears pages from books. She puts ink on other manuscripts. They open the little pond area that has water, and she starts throwing the books in the water to basically destroy everything. And what we hear is not only the tearing of the books, the shattering of glass, but also her stomping. Mm-hmm. And all of this is underscored by the song "My Tamako, My Suki." What do you think about the scene?
I loved this scene. This is one of the ones that stuck with me. I felt this scene really really built up the relationship between these two characters in a way that was moving beyond anything that was sexual. It was more an emotive. Mm. I think it showcases their intense feelings for each other, mm-hmm. and their closeness, their bond. And I don't think we get that as much in other scenes. I think when Hideko tries to hang herself and Suki saves her, I think that's when we start to get that idea that, oh, wait, they are building something.
I agree. And I find it very interesting that one of the things that I noticed when you said that you like this sequence, when we chatted briefly after the film ended, is that you said, oh, I like how her shoes sound. Mm-hmm. I hadn't noticed the stomping, but now listening to it one more time, yeah, I think this is also one of her sound cues, is that Suki stomps when she walks when she's angry. And I think a part of her character is that she cannot control her emotions as well as Hideko does, who is very good at manipulating her emotions and showing who mm-hmm. she is and how others perceive her. Suki doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. And she's also very willing to show her anger through her stomping. Mm-hmm. But also it pays a lot of attention to the shoes that Lady Hideko gave her. So it makes me think, oh, maybe the shoes are a little too big for her, right? There's something about the connection to the shoes that I think is interesting, mm-hmm. and showing her anger and the fact that this anger is like, oh, this is a person I care about. So not only am I going to show you that I'm angry and upset by like stomping my feet, mm-hmm. but also I'm doing something by tearing all these books apart.
Yeah, and it also, it highlights the environment too, because it sounds hollow. Mm. And we know that there's that basement underneath.
Oh, brilliant.
So there's that, yeah, the shoes themselves, I felt it was very resonant. And I mean, I like the way hard-heeled shoes sound on hardwood floors.
Yeah.
Not necessarily like stilettos or high heels, but those, but boots. Mm-hmm. I don't know. This is a particular sound that I actually really, I really like. And yeah, I felt like it was very much amplified in the sequence. But they also, the music itself too, and it's stuff that we've already heard before, but mm-hmm. you don't know that you've heard it before. So this scene was in Act 3, right?
Act 2. End of Act 2.
Okay. End of Act 2. So during the wedding scene, when they're running away, so Heideko can marry the count, mm-hmm. we hear the theme, which is repeated in this scene. So in a way, the composer is kind of giving you a cue. Mm-hmm. So even though the track is called, what was it called? My Tamako Maisuki. Mm-hmm. The way that I read it and the way that I understood it is that it was a theme that was directly related to them, because it only happens when they are both on screen. And the narration was talking about the names as well. So I heard it a little bit in the wedding track. It's just faintly played on the piano. Here, it's played on the piano. The melody's played by on the piano first, and then it's passed over to the strings. Mm. And when it's passed over the strings, it's just like strings just kind of swell. They just kind of open up the sonic space in general. That's the only real theme I could hear. I mean, that's repeated. So we're given that information. But I think if we watch and listen to the whole movie again, and we pay attention to the wedding scene, we are given that hint that this is not exactly what we think is happening. Mm. That was the wedding, I think, happening in Act
Probably
One. Yeah. This is not what we think is happening. Yeah.
So it's also what you were saying, right? That how, like, this is an example of how the score kind of opens up and we hear more of it. In a similar way, how the film opens mm-hmm. up and reveals more visually in terms of the architecture of the house, but also in terms of the plot mm-hmm. of who are the people and what are the actual... intrigues and the plans and who's actually in cahoots with whom.
Yeah, there's a lot of visual secrets, but I think there's like sonic secrets that come out.
That's brilliant. What is interesting for me is the juxtaposition between the sound and the visual, because the erotica that we do hear, we hear it. Mm-hmm. We don't really see it. We see some examples of the erotica being read out loud to the like as an auction, mm-hmm. which is very different the erotic scenes that we do see between Suki and Lady Hideko together. Mm-hmm. So there's something about the treatment of sex and sexuality when you listen to it compared to when you see it mm-hmm. in the film, and who gets to partake in it, who is watching whom, and for whom is this for?
Yeah, who has agency?
Yes.
Yeah, the agency changes.
Yes.
Definitely. And every time that there's any sexualized scene or that the reading of erotica, I found that the reading of the erotica really surprising. Mm-hmm. This was one of those things where I did not see that coming. This was a sharp turn.
Yeah.
Definitely for me. But in thinking about women's roles, especially in 19th and 20th century for these larger houses, now I cannot speak to the Korean or Japanese context, but within the British context or Victorian and Edwardian and even in the Porfiriato in Mexico, doing those types of readings was seen as part of being a lady. Not erotica, but just like poetry.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, not necessarily erotica, but those types of readings. Like,
right.
You know, Jane Austen had some mentions of this in her novels. Women painted. Heideko kind of paints.
yes. Yeah,
and sometimes they're pianists, but there were no music. They're not musicians in this series. But she reads and she draws.
Right. What a waste. We could have started with this because yes, mm-hmm. what does a lady do? And that's spot on. If you think of like Jane Austen or and Bridgerton right now, what are the skills that ladies have is like to play the pianoforte or to paint or to like host these readings. And I think that's a little bit of the twist that the kind of content that she's reading is different. Mm-hmm. It's still in the guise of what a lady does. But in terms of the Asian context, this is why I'm also uncomfortable with this scene, because this is also part of the different kinds of entertainment that gentlemen will go for, like geishas. They're like not only in terms of like sex work, but they were masters of their craft in terms of creating music and dancing and the presentation of themselves, being very good conversationalists. Mm-hmm. In the India context as well, there's a poet recitations. They would be the most educated women of the time because they could recite poetry, write poetry, dance, and sing. Mm-hmm. But it is with the combination of sex work that this visions of what a woman can do or how is she presented outside of society, inside of society, that gets mm-hmm. kind of muddled.
And also her clothing changes.
Yes.
So there's also something there. The actual narration of the poetry, like she's dressed up in a more traditional dress.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Japanese dress.
Japanese dress.
And hairstyle, etc.
And hairstyle and makeup.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But she's still wearing gloves.
And the gentlemen are dressed as British gentlemen.
Yeah, they're on tails.
Yes.
Yeah. Tuxedo tails.
And the reading is in Japanese.
And the reading's in Japanese.
Even though some of the readings are translated from either they are allusions to Marquis de Sade, but also one of the things that she's reading is a Chinese mm-hmm. 16th century novel. For me, it was also interesting of like the library that they destroy. It is a very international library of international erotica, which is fascinating to me of how this collection happens. But
and her voice changes.
Yeah, which is funny because she's doing the voice acting job mm-hmm. and she talks like a man.
Yes, her voice got deeper
when she was
reciting, and it contrasts to her aunt
who was
reading out loud to her. So I guess it's another way of just putting on another mask. It's like another hat to separate herself from that. That's just a very generalized reading.
But I think to me, that was also the interesting part of it, that there's something that is being done sonically in terms of eroticism, not only in the reading of mm-hmm. this literature, which not only does she deepen her voice and she has to learn how to read with a certain cadence, but she also takes the voices of the different characters. Mm-hmm. So when she's playing the part of the man, her voice is a little bit more like deeper.
And which it sounded raspy too.
Yeah. But it's also a little bit goofy, I think. Mm-hmm. Like it's like she's playing a character. She's not just narrating. She mm-hmm. is performing all the roles.
Yeah, it's a big performance. Yeah, it's a very intricate performance.
And so that was fascinating to me. I forgot. That's the thing. But that is, sonically that is being done in terms of, sonically the film is very interesting of how it plays with eroticism, not only what we see, but also what you hear. We talked a little bit after the movie that there's these moments when the sound bleeds, so there's like a sound bridge from one scene to the other, mm-hmm. and it's this the moaning and the breathing that happened in the scene before, then also you keep hearing in the scene later. So it's very interested in the question of what do you hear mm-hmm. And what makes something erotic or where something is sexualized. But then also, as a way to bring it all together, the sound of the bells towards the end of the film, and they're using these silver bells together, which before were a sign of punishment, now they are a symbol for pleasure. Mm-hmm. And they make music together.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought this was the ending was kind of a fascinating way of bringing it full circle, and but she's giving Heideko her agency, mm-hmm. her own sexual agency back, because we see her as a little kid and she's getting punished with these balls. She has to put it in her, these metal or steel balls she has to put in her mouth.
Wait, say that one more time because I don't laugh.
That Heideko is getting, when she's a little kid, she gets punished for talking back. Her uncle puts this metal ball in her mouth and then hits her hand repeatedly with a string of others. These metal balls that are attached by a pretty thick rope, mm-hmm. actually. And when she's doing one of the erotic readings, especially, it was during a almost a blackout. Mm-hmm. She was talking again about these balls, but they have chimes mm-hmm. inside them. And she was painting this this pretty elaborate scene of erotica between these two individuals, two women who are using these bells for their own pleasure. And when they are rubbed together, then they make this exquisite music. But she's doing this for this crowd of men.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, now it's her choice to actually use it, and she's not traumatized by these bells. She's not traumatized at all. She actually you know, is more accepting of them. Mm-hmm. But now it's her choice to use them. And when she was actually narrating this part to the men, the sound design did play little bell tingles, almost like a wind chime.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was just brilliant. Mm. I just thought that was just great. And then they bring it back towards the end. And that's when they have like, yeah, they make their own music.
And what I like about the scene, as you were saying, it has all of the elements that you see throughout the film, like the symmetry that has been there. Mm-hmm. Throughout the film is there the symmetry that talks about the many layers of the film. There's two characters that are playing two different roles. There's two languages that are being spoken throughout, etc. But also is that going back to the water, mm-hmm. the moment of the library, it is not through fire that they destroy these books, but it actually are put them in water.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting way of like at that moment that was very important for the relationship is also being then shown again through the bells, but also through the water because
they're
in the boat. And these are the two sounds that we hear as they're leaving is the lapping of the water mm-hmm. and the sound of the bells.
That's kind of like a baptism of sorts.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
It's like definitely like a new beginning for sure.
Yeah, a rebirth mm-hmm. of both of them, their new identities.
Yeah, very literally new identities because they take new passports, new photos,
mm-hmm.
A different way of very much signaling new beginnings.
Yeah, new beginnings. So kind of wondering where that relationship went.
Yeah, I mean, now we have to read the novel.
Now we have to read
we
the
really
novel.
Do. Jackie, it's been a lot of fun. Very interesting talking about this film with you and pay attention to sound. But now, are you ready for your rapid fire questions?
Sure.
Sharp turns?
Sharp turns.
In a sharp turn, we're going to go into the rapid fire questions. Jackie, what is your favorite movie snack?
Popcorn.
Movie theater or streaming?
That's dependent on the mood. I think right now it's streaming.
Okay. Trailers or no spoilers?
Oh, trailers.
Movie you would like to see again for the first time?
The Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, nice. Movie you watch way too young.
God, this is Kevin Costner movie called Revenge.
Uh-huh.
That was terrible. I think that was the first nude scene I've ever seen.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
One of your favorite movies?
Mermaids.
Oh. And one film that is required watching or that you think everybody should watch or that is always in your syllabi?
Oh, I know. Hable con ella. Pedro Almodovar's Hable con ella.
Okay. Well, Jackie, thank you so much. It was lovely having you in the podcast.
Thank you, Ruby. This was fun.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you for listening to Watch Next. A huge thanks to our guests for joining us today and to everyone at Leitz and at UT Austin's College of Liberal Arts and the Department of Asian Studies for making this show possible. Make sure to subscribe so you never miss a conversation. Leave us a rating or a review to help other listeners discover the filmmakers and scholars we feature. New episodes drop every 2 weeks. Listen to Watch Next wherever you get your podcasts.